We are welcoming a new show to iHeart and the DraftKings YouTube channel. It is called Point Game with John Wall and CJ Toledano. It is an insider look at the NBA and the coaches surrounding the league. Every week, the five-time All-Star and the number one pick in the 2010 NBA Draft, John Wall, will give his unique perspective on hot topics in the league and tell the best behind-the-scenes stories from his time in the NBA. So check out Point Game with John Wall and CJ Toledano on the iHeartRadio app, the DraftKings YouTube channel, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The hit movie Bob Marley One Love is now streaming on Paramount Plus. Celebrate the life of an icon who inspired generations with his message of love, peace, and unity. Rated PG-13. Head to ParamountPlus.com/OneLove to try it free now.
Welcome back to Dealing Together. First caller?
I bought 3 sweaters to get the 4th free.
Oh, you got fleeced. Next caller?
I traded my old Samsung at AT&T for a new Samsung Galaxy S24 Plus and chose my plan.
That's not a bad deal.
It is not.
Our best smartphone deals. Your choice of plan. Learn how to get the new Samsung Galaxy S24 Plus with Galaxy AI on us with eligible trade-in. AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Offers vary by device. Subject to change. S24 plus 256GB offer available for a limited time. Terms and restrictions apply. See att.com/Samsung for details.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Wake that ass up.
Early in the morning.
The Breakfast Club.
Morning, everybody. It's DJ Envy, Angela Yee, Charlamagne Tha God. We are The Breakfast Club. We got a special guest in the building. She's running for U.S. Senate of Louisiana, Syreeta Stibe. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. Good morning.
Did I say your name right?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Imagine
welcome.
That.
Welcome.
Now, I actually met Syreeta through my good friend Topeka Sam, and the two of you collaborate on a lot of different projects together.
Yes, absolutely.
So let's talk about your background. And I think people need to hear your story. We were actually in New Orleans. And when I tell you, we went out to eat at Murrow's, and she had people at the table crying, just talking about her story and how she's gotten to where she is now.
Yeah, so a little bit about me and my story. It starts probably really early on in childhood. I had experiences with abuse throughout my life, and by the age of 19, it kind of led me to a path where I felt like I was really angry and upset all of the time, and just really caused me to make a lot of bad decisions, irrespective of like where I was in my life. So I was on a full scholarship to Xavier University in New Orleans in physics and engineering, and in the United States Navy. But by the time I was 19, I found myself in prison. So I was sentenced to 10 years in federal prison, 20 years in state prison, $1.9 million in restitution, all for the same crime.
What did you do?
So my charge was usurfying to commit a felony. We stole cars from a car dealership and blew the car dealership up.
What? Okay, so you stole cars from the car dealership.
Yes.
How many cars?
I think we were charged with 6.
6, okay. And how many were you guys?
It was 4 total.
4 of you guys.
Mm-hmm.
And then why did you blow up the car dealership?
Because one of my co-defendants thought his face was on the camera, that he could be caught, and that was the first thing that we thought of, you know, to cover your track.
Smart.
You know?
Well, I mean, it wasn't smart, but I would have thought the same thing. Now, let me
at the age of 19. And Envy, I'm going to say this is interesting because we had this debate the other day about when people do things as a youth when they're young and they make these huge mistakes in their life and how forgiving people should be of that once, you know, they do go to jail, or is there some type of rehab that can happen without jail?
So I definitely do not think that jail is rehabilitative. You know,
how much time did you serve?
9 years and 2 months.
Wow.
For a crime that normally would have held about 3 years, but because I was sentenced in the federal system and I was sentenced under mandatory minimums. You know, that's a big thing across the country right now. People who are doing obscene amount of time because of mandatory minimums. That was my case. So my judge had no discretion. I didn't have priors, you know, or anything like that. But that was my mandatory minimum. And then one of the things that I'm working with Topeka now on is that I had restitution as well. Mm-hmm. So I was sentenced under the Mandatory Victims Restitution Act, which made it necessary, or like the judge also didn't have any leniency to go either way, that they had to impose restitution. So that is how I ended up with the 10 years in the federal system, $1.9 million in restitution. And then the state came in and said, hey, we want to charge you with a part of the crime in the state as well. Mm-hmm. And that was how I got the 20 years in the state.
So I was going to ask, so for most people don't know, and this is what really irks me when it comes to a lot of this stuff. So when you stole the vehicles, why did you steal them?
Money.
To sell them?
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
So now, and this is why I say this always bothers me, because you get a lot of kids, and that's yourself, teenagers, they steal these cars, and they get $2,000, $3,000 a car. How much was you getting a car at that time?
About $20,000.
$20,000 a car. And you sell it to a guy that's selling it and probably getting $70,000, $80,000 a
absolutely.
Car.
Absolutely.
But that person that was selling it for $70,000, $80,000 and shipping them overseas and getting the big dollars, he was never caught.
No, and you know... I was listening to DMX and Rough Riders a lot around that time. Mm-hmm. So Eve had this amazing song called Ride or Die Chick.
Ride or Die Chick.
Yeah, I really believed that, you know, in my head at the time. And I, you know, we didn't cooperate, didn't talk about it, didn't say anything about it, because I felt like if you had evidence on the person, you could get it, you know, whatever. But not even realizing, like, the level of preying people do on young kids, mm-hmm. and you're... You know that they're in hard situations or tough situations. So, like, my story was that I was in the military. At that time, I was making $410 every 2 weeks. But I was already, you know, had a car, had responsibilities. I went to my superiors in the Navy. I'm like, hey, I need to get another job. They're like, no, you know, just let everything go and you can get it back. And I was like, I can't do that. Like, how am I gonna drive? You know, at 19, I can't even comprehend letting my car go.
Right.
You know?
And it really bothers me because, you know, especially, I mean, you know now, car thefts are through the roof right now.
Yeah, New Orleans is horrible.
And mostly what they do is they get these, they prey on these 16-year-olds, 17-year-olds, and 18-year-olds, right? And usually because if they get caught, they come out right away and then they can get back and doing it. And they pay these kids $3,000 to $5,000 a car. Now, these kids are stealing McLarens, Rolls Royces, Ferraris, Lamborghinis, Fords, Kias. And then they ship these cars overseas for $30,000, $40,000, $50,000. But these kids are risking their life for $3,000. And not just jail time, because you run into the wrong house or you run into the wrong car and somebody shoots at you and puts them in a bad predicament. And we was having this conversation on air. That was like, I understand and I feel bad for these kids, because they're looking at it as, oh, this is a quick $3,000 flip. Somebody left their key fob and I'm going to take it, you know, which is really sad. So what happened with the restitution? Because you owed 1.9. Did you have to pay that back? Or are you still paying it back? How does it work?
So I paid on the restitution for 20 years on Trump's last day in office. Same day that Lil Wayne got his pardon, I got a full presidential pardon as well. So it took away my restitution, the crime, the federal system, and it was wiped away. But I paid, I mean, the way the federal system is set up, you pay while you're incarcerated as well. So it's really your family paying. So from the time I stepped foot in prison till the time I stepped foot out, I paid for 20 years.
So how do you feel about Donald Trump? Because, you know, a lot of people hate Donald Trump. And mm-hmm. you look at people like Lil Wayne and you look at people like Kodak and yourself. You can't necessarily hate a man that freed you, right?
Absolutely. But... What you was about to say?
Oh, no, I was saying, but it was a presidential pardon. You were already out.
Yes, okay. yes. But he freed me from the sentence and the correct. Restitution and all that stuff, mm-hmm. right? I think that God could use the devil to bless you. I'm going to start there. And then there's a saying that says a broken clock can be right twice a day.
Mm-hmm.
The other fallacy is that he gave me something. He did grant me a pardon, but every day since I have been out, I have worked. You know, to change laws, to liberate people, to really give back to a community that is always forgotten about. So I deserved it, you know. So for me, it was, I just, you know, everything just coming full circle and a culmination, I felt like, of all of the work that I had been putting in over the last few years. So I do think that if I'm working for people, it is my job to work with whoever I need to work with in order to get the things that my community needs.
Did he ever try to come back out to you and try to use you as a tool because he granted you this?
Absolutely not. He does not talk about my pardon. Mm. He don't mention it at all. And, you know, he endorsed Senator Kennedy in Louisiana. So, no, absolutely not.
Yeah. Okay, so let's get into some of why you're running for U.S. Senate, because, like you said, since you've been home, you've been working to change these laws. You yourself have experienced things, and so you can understand people in the community in a different way than other people can relate to them. So what made you decide that it was time for you to run for this particular office? I know you've worked with the mayor, Mayor Cantrell, in New Orleans very closely, and with Reform Alliance, and making sure you have these programs that are helping women get back into society, knowing the problems and issues that you had when you first got home.
The simple explanation for me is definitely, I feel like it's a calling, you know, that's been placed on my life. Anybody who knows me, I'm real stubborn. I don't make decisions lightly or take things for granted that I have, or the experiences that I have. But I remember right before I went to prison, I was having this argument, I felt like, with God in the car. I literally walked out of church. It was Mardi Gras. I was 19, and I'm having a conversation with God, and I hear him saying, you need to be in church. You need to listen. You need to do this. And in my mind, I'm like, no, I'm 19. I want to party. I want to drink. I want to smoke weed. I want to have fun. And it was like this argument I felt like that I was having, you know, with God on my conscience, or, you know, whatever. And that, I feel like that disobedience caused me to be in prison for 10 years. So I feel like my disobedience comes at a different cost. So when I got this message about 2 years ago, it took me a while. You know, I tried to do everything in my power to convince myself that this is what I shouldn't be doing. I did a poll. I talked to people, all of these things. But I still came to the same conclusion that this was something that I needed to do. Over the last few years, I've definitely been working in the legislative space on a federal level and a state level. When I got out of prison, I couldn't go to college. I was denied the opportunity to go to college because there's also the box, have you been convicted of a felony, on college applications. So I applied, I was denied. 2 years later, I used the same exact application. The only change I made was I unchecked the box and I got in, I got scholarships. And, you know, fundamentally that just didn't feel good. So after I graduated from college, I have a degree in clinical laboratory science. I work in a hospital prior to opening my nonprofit. We went back in and we were like, something has to change. So we passed legislation in the state of Louisiana in 2017 to remove the box off college applications for purposes of admissions. And we made Louisiana the first state to do that. So since then, we've passed similar legislation in 6 other states, supporting advocates on the ground in those states to, like, change the laws and advocate for their community. Every year since 2017, I've passed at least one piece of legislation in the state of Louisiana, the Dignity Act. We passed the primary caretaker legislation. A lot of those bills have been copied in places like California. And on a federal level, we work to remove the question off of the Common App for students to apply who have convictions. We were able to put inside of the COVID omnibus bill, we were able to slide some legislation that gave people who are incarcerated access to Pell Grants. So there's a lot of work that I've been doing to, you know, in the liberation of my people and trying to make sure that people who have made mistakes have access to the things that they need in order to begin to try to change their lives.
Because imagine you go to jail all that time, right? Then you come home, you have this restitution that you're supposed to pay back. You can't even get into college. People don't want to hire you because you check that box. And even finding housing or just getting back into things, it's not it. Who did help you when you got out?
It was other formerly incarcerated women. Like, I had one woman who I was incarcerated with. We were roommates. We were in the same institutions for about 5 years. Like, she brought me my first cell phone, you know. Another one of my friends, who is now my son's godmother, she was standing outside the gate with my mom and my sister. She showed me how to, you know, fill out an application. She helped me to apply for a job. She helped me to do my FAFSA application. Mm-hmm. One of them gave me $300 every semester to help buy books. So it was really like this informal network of formerly incarcerated women who, like, showed up and said, we got you. We've walked this path. Let's do this together. And then I knew, you know, innately that is what I had to do for other women, you know. So that is how I started my organization, Operation Restoration.
I was going to ask something that stuck with me, something that you said. You said that you were listening to music. You were a heavy DMX fan, and you were listening to Eve and Ride or Die, and that's what you thought you should do. So how do you look at artists now and their music now, because, you know, people say, you know, it's just entertainment, but obviously it had a heavy influence on you. In Louisiana, the crime rate is through the roof, like Absolutely. A lot of our urban cities. So how do you look at music and things that the kids hear now?
I think music, we cannot deny, has an effect on people. We talk about being creatives and making music, and painting has like this healing effect mm-hmm. on a person, like getting out the things that they want to get out. But we also have to acknowledge and be aware and responsible for the messages that we are putting out that have the opposite effect. You know, everything in life has good intentions, some have bad intentions, mm-hmm. but the intentionality is just the same. So I think that as a community, we have to push the narrative that this is entertainment. Mm-hmm. I think when I was growing up in the 90s, it wasn't being pushed as entertainment, it was being pushed as a way of life. Mm-hmm. So this was being fed to kids and, you know, teenagers like myself, like, this is what you have to do in order to be here. And I think that that is one thing that I'm grateful for, is through the evolution of music, we now begin to talk about it as if it's entertainment versus a way of life.
But it is so too, you can't snitch, right? Because that's part of it also. Seriously though, because people look at you, so if you were to be like, look, this is the person that is in charge.
But she was being preyed upon as a young teen.
Right.
That's very different.
But you also know that too, that you can't tell, because now what? After I done told who the real person is, now what happens to me?
So I think the streets a long time ago were a lot different. I feel like now people, you know, are being, it's okay to tell. Like that culture has also changed too, because mm-hmm. like, you know, 20, 30 years ago, a person would tell what happened and they would come up missing, or they had some type of repercussions or consequences. Now it is not frowned upon. People are telling all the time. I don't know. It's just different, right? But I think that what I had to do and reconcile for myself is, like, while, you know, Envy pointed out, yeah, like, I was being preyed upon, I was also raised to take responsibility, like, for my actions.
Yeah.
So I was guilty. I did do what they said that I did, and I was gonna serve my time. I pled guilty, you know, even though at the time I didn't even understand what I was pleading guilty to. I pled guilty because I did exactly what they said that I did. Mm-hmm.
I get that, but see, you also got to understand is there's an adult here, right? That even though you could say snitching and not snitching, I think a lot of it's bullshit, but there's an adult here that finds young teens and says, this kid has no money. This kid is effed up. This kid has no schooling, no education, doesn't know, and just wants to get out. I can prey on this kid and get him to do what I want him to do, and that's not right.
No.
And people could call that snitching or whatever, but...
But it's no different than it's abuse. It's no different
than
you know, exactly. Somebody being molested, somebody being
Absolutely.
Sexually assaulted, because it takes the same level of person that is preying
yes.
on an individual. So in that sense, I, you know,
snitching
totally...
out the window there. You
I understand.
A grown man coercing a kid to do something crazy. Absolutely. That's foul. That's not like y'all all say, all right, we're going to do this crime together, we do it. No.
But
you had an adult that says... Hey, because why didn't an adult do it? The adult didn't do it because the adult knew better.
But at the time, the person that's being preyed upon looks as the prey. You know, there's all type of, like, you know, syndromes that are associated with, like, a person who is causing you to do, you know, incorrect things or things that you shouldn't be doing. You also see them as a savior in
right.
a lot of ways
right.
because, you know, the reason why they can offer kids $3,000 to do a thing, and this is not all kids, because I didn't come from a socioeconomic background
mm-hmm.
associated with people who you think are in prison. My mom was a judge when I went to prison.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my dad was a supervisor at an oil refinery. So what led me to prison was trauma. It wasn't poverty.
Mm-hmm.
But people who are in poverty, people who don't own anything other than their Facebook page, and that's in debate whether they own it or not, the only thing that you feel like you have is your self-respect or your self-worth. When somebody tries to take that from you, that is why kids feel like I can take someone's life in the commission of this.
A judge, though?
Absolutely.
And your mom, we can talk about it now. Your mom didn't try to turn, like, make some moves because she's a judge.
So she did. My mom, shout out to my mom. Her birthday's tomorrow.
Happy birthday, mama.
She definitely did. She did everything in her power to, like, extricate me from the system. But when she talks about it from her point of view, she felt like they were more harsh on me because of who she was.
Mm.
And then if you also think about it, like, we're from the South. You know, there's this air of, you know, people of color shouldn't be doing certain things. So she feels like a lot of what I went through was because of who she was, right. You know?
They were like, we'll show you.
Yeah, like, yeah, you're a judge, but you're not really anything, so we're going to, you know, prosecute your daughter to the fullest.
Did you ever talk to the owner of the car shop? Did you ever go back and be like, you know what? Let me have this conversation with him. I was young, dumb, and stupid. Did you ever have that convo?
So let me tell you.
Oh, boy.
The guy who owned our car dealership at the time, he didn't know. I mean, we didn't know. The dealership was in like extreme distress. So they were really investigating him initially for burning down his own car dealership. They thought it was like an insurance scheme or whatever.
So he was halfway kind of happy.
Absolutely.
Thanks, y'all.
Thanks.
But he died, I want to say not even a year after we committed the crime. And I never had an opportunity to, like, talk to him or say anything to him about, like, why we did what we did. Mm-hmm. But I think, like, if I had that opportunity, I've thought about, like, saying why we did it or what was going on, but it's really like no explanation other than like I was in a really
stupid,
yeah, like tough place, you know, like I felt like life didn't care about me, I didn't care about anybody else at the time, so it was just really like not a decision that really, you know, sometimes they say you want to go and talk to the person who harmed you and like you don't get the closure that you need because a lot of times people don't even know why they did a thing. Like he could probably stand up, scream, say whatever, and I would just be like, okay, because
you understand.
I don't have an explanation.
I don't have an explanation. There's no explanation.
Now, you talk about being incarcerated and how it's not rehabilitative. So what was your time like?
So I grew up in the country, in rural Louisiana. No fast food places, no major grocery chains, like nothing. Sugarcane. You walk out our house, sugarcane fields. So we did a lot of fighting growing up, you know. Mm-hmm. When I graduated from high school, I was voted the class revolutionist. They say they knew I was always going to fight about something, you know. I used to fight people. Mm-hmm. Now I fight systems, you know, but I'm still a fighter, you know, by nature. So my first 5 years were extremely hard because I was 19 when I went in, really, really young, one of the youngest people on the compound. They only had, I think, two of us that were teenagers, you know, in the prison. And that came with, you know, constantly being exposed to, like, people preying on you, whether it was people that were incarcerated, whether it was the guards, you know, whatever. It was not an easy situation. And I think, like, a lot of times people's family members, they don't understand, like, when you come to visitation or you see people, you know, it's all very superficial, because if I, like, really had to tell you about the experiences that I'm having while I'm incarcerated, you know, visitation would turn into something different, and that's your happy place, you know? So it's also a very isolating experience. Mm-hmm. It is meant to isolate you from your family and the world as you know it. And I think that, you know, that is what incarceration is really successful at, is making you feel extreme, deep, you know, isolation. I remember when September 11th hit, I was actually in lockdown. I was in the hole. I did a year, you know, no telephone, no commissary, like nothing, no interaction with anybody. And the things that you hear or you see during those times, you know, people losing their minds, like, you know, solitary confinement, you know, there's a big movement around the country right now about stopping the use of solitary confinement because what it does to people's mental health. And I think that, you know, like all of those things are really real. And I've been out of prison. I got out of prison in 2009. And it's still some things that, like, sometimes I'm sitting in my house, I have two kids now, you know, I'm married. Oh, my son told me to say his name on the radio this morning, Ethan. So I have to say, hey, Ethan. He was like, give me a shout out.
Good morning, Ethan.
You better shout out both the kids.
Yeah, but Sage is not two yet. So okay. She doesn't know what's going on. She don't know what's happening yet. And then my wife, Montrell. But she said, when you're in there and you have, like, those experiences, I'm like sitting at home and I have like a deep craving for like extreme isolation. Like, I don't want to be bothered with anybody. I don't want to talk to people. And then I have to like gather myself and center myself and be like, Sarita, that's some prison shit. You got to let that go, you know? And I find myself doing that. And I've been out, you know, since 2009. So it is something that definitely affects you for the rest of your life.
So I was going to ask, when you become senator, what's the because you got to put it out there, right?
Yes.
What's the first thing that you want to do? Is it the flooding? Is it abortion? Is it violence? Is it helping more black people get homes? Like, what is the first thing that you want to attack when it comes to that?
Well, definitely, you know, every day that I wake up as a Black woman in America. And I think that our rights as women are like under severe attack. Mm-hmm. And I think that no matter where you're located, that is true. And I think it's really heightened inside a prison. So, you know, like if you think reproductive health is under attack outside of prison, inside of prison, it is horrible, you know? And I think for me, my focus, you know, on day one, which for me, I am the only person in this race that has experience and that can create policy from day one and get it passed. You know, I have a history of getting legislation passed in hostile conditions. Like Louisiana is almost a super majority of Republican. Like there's no bipartisan legislation in Louisiana. It would really be to protect, how do we begin to protect the rights of women? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, like what's next? The right to vote? Mm-hmm. You know, our marriages are under attack. Mm-hmm. You know, abortion is under attack. There's all these different things that are specific to women that are under attack. I think that I would be remiss to focus on anything other than that initially. But, you know, my vision of the day that I take office is something that is very, very important to me as well. It's like I want to bring 100 girls, you know, with me on the day that I take office, because when I was working Capitol Hill, I would go to each office and begin to talk to the senators that are there. And there was no one that looked like me, that could relate to me, you know, that I could have a great conversation with. Like, that just didn't exist. And I think it is very important that we begin to stretch the minds of young people and expose them to things that are possible. Absolutely. Because if they can see it, then they can believe it and they can start working toward it. So,
how many Black women have had a seat in the Senate in Louisiana?
Oh, so there's no Black woman who has ever been elected statewide in the state of Louisiana. So it's not even just in the Senate. It's no statewide office ever in the state of Louisiana.
Which is ridiculous.
Absolutely.
Talk about no representation at all.
Zero.
Now, you're also, and I saw this, right? So it's like a three people being endorsed by the Democratic Party in Louisiana, which is unusual. So,
well, not really. They did it in the Congress race, the same race that Gary was in the last time. They gave three endorsements.
But so is that a controversial thing for them to do that?
Absolutely. It's not a controversial thing for them to do it because it's precedent. They did it in the last endorsement, set of endorsements. But the system as a whole is problematic. Mm-hmm. You know, the way that it is set up and the way that the endorsement process happens needs to be looked at and it needs to be worked on. I think that when you get to endorsing too many people, it's like you can't make a decision like, oh, should it be this person, that person? But I am elated to have the you know, the endorsement, simply because even though there are 13 people in the race and they are talking about four of us pretty consistently, I'm in that fourth position right now. And it is really focused on money, finances. You know, we could have a whole nother conversation about viability and how we judge people who are viable in races based on structural racism, you know. Black people are not connected to wealth in the same way that white people are connected to wealth. We know this. This is a fact. And the idea that we are going to judge candidates not based on their body of work, but how much money that they can raise, is something that we really have to look at and begin to talk about. But I went into that endorsement meeting process not expecting to get the endorsement of the party, because I knew where I was as it related to the order of how we're running and how other endorsements have been going out. But I use every opportunity to just talk to people and let them know who I am and the things that I want to work on and how, you know, anything that I do in a spirit of collaboration. Like, I want to take people with me. I don't want to do anything for anybody. I want us to do it together. And that's how I approach everything that I do. So I was really just looking at it as an opportunity to speak to a larger body of people across the state that I may not have had a chance to speak to otherwise. So when I walked out, you know, with the triple endorsement, you know, I was happy.
Like, yeah, and I wasn't even expecting.
Yeah, and I'm going to act like I was the only one endorsed. You know, I'm moving forward.
Because we've had Gary Chambers up here before a couple of times. And, you know, that's also another debate within the Democratic Party, is being really progressive a hindrance, especially in some place like Louisiana.
It's a tough one, man, because you and Gary seem like you fought the people so much.
Yeah, Gary and I have had a lot of conversations. We've really talked about things because the one thing that I am is always for the people and what's best for the community. But again, I go back to I'm the only one with the experience in the race. This is something that I do. You know, I have a resume behind me. I'm not always comfortable like talking about it and screaming from the rooftops. That's why a lot of people are like, my God, like you've done so much, but you fly under the radar. It's like, yeah, because I have my head down and I'm working. I'm not necessarily paying attention to who's watching what I do. So that is something that I am trying to get better at, is like being able to talk about the things that we've done to build a platform, because I know that that's also very powerful in being able to liberate the communities that we're working toward. But, you know, Gary does have experience, you know, running races. That is what he's done. You know, the last congressional race, you know, he talks about he's the person that has a voter base and he's able to get people out and, you know, all of these different things, which is true. Like, that has actually happened. But I mean, the last congressional race that he ran in, it was for a black congressional district. He finished third to two other black candidates. And I think that that is like a narrative that, you know, we don't talk about. And even with the endorsement meeting, like, he didn't have the nomination yet. What they stopped from happening was the actual vote for the larger body of whether or not he would receive the nomination. So it was a recommendation from the executive committee to endorse him, but the larger body had to vote on it. And what they did was they stopped that vote, the larger body, from voting on it because someone introduced a resolution because they said that the bylaws had changed. People hadn't really had a chance to look over them. And the larger body was really unhappy that everybody didn't get an opportunity to address them. So I think that if we're going to talk about, like, there's enough structural racism, there's enough, you know, genderism, there's all of these things that truly exist in Louisiana, and we have to talk about them and we have to begin to fight those systems, but we can't do it in ways I think that are harmful. And I think that what is happening right now in Louisiana is the focus is truly not on Senator Kennedy, and that's where everybody's focus should be, is like, how do we get him out?
Because he has Trump's endorsement, right?
He does. He was one of the six senators who voted not to impeach, you know, all of those things. So he's one of the holdouts.
He also believes that Mar-a-Lago was, that raid on the house was wrong.
Absolutely, absolutely. The crazy thing about him is he has developed this persona over the years that he's this uneducated, you know, they call him Foghorn Longhorn, all of these things. Like, he's really intentional about this character. But this man is he has an undergrad degree from Vanderbilt. He has a law degree from UVA. He has another law degree from Oxford. He used to be a Democrat. He's one of the most intelligent, smartest people that you would ever meet. Like, if you go back to his earlier days, he said a lot of things. Like, he was so loud when our past Governor Jindal didn't want to take money from the federal government about why we needed that to happen. To see him from then to now and this persona that he has created, because he believes that this is what people of Louisiana want or like or need, it is so insulting. And it's disgusting.
Crazy. We got to go back and look at his past.
Absolutely. Yes, he's disgusting.
And you also, I want to talk about this school, because like you said, you don't really talk about the things that you have implemented and done, but you've also helped other people become lab technicians?
Can you
talk about that a little bit? Because I just saw that recently, another class graduated.
Yes. So that is one of, like, something that I'm extremely proud of. So when I started going back to school, I wanted to go to medical school. I don't know if it was naivete or what it was, but I just knew I was going to go to school and be a doctor. But when I got on the path and the journey of doing my undergrad degree and I found out about clinical laboratory science, that's what my degree is in, I kind of fell in love with it. And I was like, okay, I'm going to get a working degree because I'm in my 30s. I got a kid. I need to work and go to school. So I'm going to get this working degree and I'm going to go to med school and I'm going to, you know, raise my 3-year-old son. Like, you know, that was my goal. So the way that I did it was I became a lab assistant while I was working on my clinical laboratory science degree. And what I found out is, like, all of the barriers that you have to overcome to enter a profession at a higher level were kind of lessened at a lower level. So when I decided to open the nonprofit, I wanted to create a lab assistant program where women could get certified and licensed as lab assistants, and then that would be their entryway into healthcare fields. And then from there, they could upgrade their degree. They can go to a 2-year MLT degree or a 4-year MLS degree. They could go to be midwives, doctors, whatever they wanted to do, because once they went through that initial entry point as a lab assistant, then the ceiling, you know, became unreachable. So it didn't happen. You know, worked on it, created 15 other programs mm-hmm. before that one actually took off. So we were able to get some funding and support from multiple entities, the Hilton Foundation, Blue Cross Blue Shield of Louisiana, just all of these different places, because with the COVID pandemic definitely showed was that there was a shortage of mm-hmm. lab personnel and people to like work in the laboratory setting, which is something we've all known for years, but it really heightened it. So there was an appetite to do a rapid reskilling program and do a program inside of the prison to get people certified and licensed as lab assistants. So we began working with hospitals to get job placement and just all of these different things. And to date, we have graduated in the last 6 months, close to 30 women.
Hey, congrats.
Yeah, I love that. Actionable things.
Yeah, congrats. And they are being placed in hospitals now. We help them, you know, we do everything. We do the teaching. We pay any probation fees that they need in order to maintain their licensure. We pay for the applications, their fingerprints. We will buy uniforms. We help with childcare. We help with transportation. Because, you know, people think that when you give somebody an opportunity, that's all that they need.
Gotcha.
But if you're not invested in a person taking advantage of the opportunity, it's like you haven't even given it to them. It's still out of reach because they can't do all of the things that they need in order to grab hold of the opportunity. So all of the programs at the organization, at Operation Restoration, are really like holistic and built in a way where, like, mm-hmm. if you don't do this thing, it's truly because you're not ready right. at this time, because we try to foresee any barrier and remove it for you.
And when is the election?
November 8th.
November 8th.
So yes.
For everybody listening and they love your story and they want to support, how can they support you?
Yeah, campaigns need money, people, okay? Kennedy has a whole lot of money in his campaign right now, so we got to make sure Sarita is competitive in that way also.
Absolutely. I think that our community doesn't really understand, in the same way that other communities know, that like people tell me, Sarita, I'm going to vote for you. And I'm like, thank you so much. I appreciate it. But if we don't get some money, you won't be able to vote
Even
for me.
Even if you could do $10, guys, everything yes. helps.
So on all social medias, my handles are Support Sarita Saib. So that's on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. It's Support Sarita Saib.
SyritaSteib.
Yeah, okay. There you go, Yee. Yeah.
Support Sarita. And that's the website as well?
And the website is just www.saritasaib.com.
Yeah, I'm glad that you came up here, because I did want you to just, your story to me is so fascinating. And the work that you do also is like very organic. And I just feel like you'll be doing this regardless. It's not you're doing this because you're running for office. This is the work that you've been putting in prior to this. And voices like this, we need. And so just for Louisiana to hopefully get some diversity and representation, for a black woman to finally have this type of position would be really important.
Yeah, and I'm the only woman in the race. And I am also pro-choice and all of the things that I think that I know how to, you know, fight for as it relates to women. But
protecting marriage rights?
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, my wife. If they take away, you know, marriage protection rights, like, it affects me, like, my wife and myself, we met when we were 19. She's mm-hmm. formerly incarcerated as well. She does amazing work in the bail industry, the Safety and Freedom Fund in New Orleans, because that's one of the programs that we bond people out who are unable to pay their bond. But I mean, it's like, this is what we do all day, every day. This is who we are. And people say, Sarita, like, why are you running? It is not just because I feel like I have to. It is also like, this is the next iteration of the places that we have been locked out of, and that it is my responsibility to do everything in my power to grant access to spaces for people to begin to say what their needs are and say, hey, this is what we want. This is the type of the policy that we need to see to bring relief to our communities. I don't think that, you know, my place in life is to do things for our people. It is to support and do things with people so that they can get the things that they need. So that is my driving force. I've done a lot of work on the federal level, but what I also understood is, like, people don't even know what senators do. You know, like, what they're responsible for. And
we've seen some of them blocking bills.
Man, listen, the U.S. Senate is the long game. Like, you know, for real, like, the things that we are fighting for today will affect your children and your grandchildren. Like, what we're seeing today in the world is from the Clinton administration, you know, the Bush administration. It's not from Biden and Trump. We haven't even seen those effects
right yet.
And I think that people just really, really don't understand that, and they don't grasp all of the things that right. the U.S. senators are responsible for.
Well, I just donated, so you go out there and you donate right now.
Please.
It doesn't. You can start off with $10. I mean, on the tab is a little more than that, but you can donate whatever you want. All right. So just
make sure. No, federal elections, the maximum is $2,900. You can't donate more than $2,900. I'm gonna have to send it back to you.
Yeah. So you can donate up to, you know, anyone you want. $10, $100, $255, $1,000, $15, $2, or $2,900, like she said. Yee, did you donate yet?
No, but I'm going to.
All right.
Well, put you on the spot.
Do it now. I just did. Make sure you donate. Again, it's Syrita Steib, SyritaSteib.com. And we appreciate you for joining us this morning.
Yes. Thank y'all so much for having me. You just don't know how much I appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. It's The Breakfast Club. Good morning.
The hit movie Bob Marley One Love is now streaming on Paramount Plus. Celebrate the life of an icon who inspired generations with his message of love, peace, and unity. Rated PG-13. Head to ParamountPlus.com/OneLove to try it free now.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
The Toolkit Podcast is where your favorite filmmakers come to talk about their craft and process.
I don't want a sloppy angle in my movie ever.
It's like being a dancer. You find the freedom in the structure.
It's where Tarantino, Gerwig, Scorsese, and Jordan Peele discuss their latest films, and showrunners take us behind the scenes of the best of TV.
Hosted by IndieWire's craft team, Toolkit is an award-winning podcast that gets at the heart of what really matters for filmmakers like Spike Lee.
It comes back to this storytelling. What can I use in my toolbox